An unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas, having it to see and listen to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome, and thank you all for driving up the snowy roads and arriving here on this beautiful in-and-out spring day with the weather and all. I'm Carolyn, and I'm one of the teachers here, and it's my great pleasure and honor to introduce you to Paula Arai, in case you don't know her, she has so many talents and accomplishments. I'm going to try to keep it brief because this isn't a talent or an accomplishment, but she's also a very genuine and humble person. So she's a professor. She has a doctorate from Harvard, and her specialty is Buddhist studies, particularly women in Buddhism, and she now holds the seat of, if you can correct me if I don't have the name exactly right, Paula, but of women's studies at the Institute of Buddhist Studies in Berkeley, which was specially created, and she is the first chair there. She's a very deep scholar and also practitioner who studied, practiced, and did her researches in Japan for many years, and mostly with Japanese women, lay women, as well as nuns. So she has deep grounding for several years, I think 7 or 8 she lived in Japan, in the practical as well as the scholarly and theoretical. And she's also very much interested in the arts, particularly Japanese. She's the author of the book Painting Enlightenment, which highlights the amazing, truly awe-inspiring work of Mr. Iwasaki, whom she was fortunate to meet his wife through her studies of women and then got to know the whole family, and wrote this wonderful book and has curated exhibitions around the country and is still working to bring his work to a wider audience. Mr. Iwasaki was a scholar, but he also was also a deep practitioner of Buddhism, and his form of practice was to write the Heart Sutra in large and small paintings. He created many of these. So Paula has brought his work to the world, and she just also here at Jikoji with a group of interested women, she created a ceremony to honor all the Buddhist lineages that we know of currently, and that still a bit of a work in progress, but Pamela Brown had this inspiration to create a ceremony, and she reached out, of course, to Paula, and Paula was instrumental in creating it, which many of us here at Jikoji, which was kind of a sponsor of this work, worked together and held the ceremony last September and hope to hold it again. So thank you so much for coming to be with us today, Paula, and for bringing your words to us.
Well, thank you all for coming here today. I have never been happier to arrive at a place on time. So I'm just feeling very grateful and happy to be here. So I'm born here safe and sound. So I just want to mention one thing. The chair I hold is called the Eshin-ni and Kakushin-ni chair in Women in Buddhism. And I want to just say those names because, as far as I know, it's the first academic endowed chair named after nuns, Buddhist, maybe Catholic, I don't know, but Buddhist nuns. I've never heard of such a thing. And the Institute of Buddhist Studies, its roots are in Jodo Shinshu, True Pure Land Buddhism, and it was the women of the Buddhist Women's Association who decided they wanted this, and they made it happen. And so I know this is a Zen temple, but I'm going to bring in some Pure Land materials, Pure Land Buddhist women, because they are so amazing. And I would like to share a little about them as well. Is my voice loud enough in the back?
Yes.
Okay. Eyes are changing, so I actually need 16-point font next time. I thought 14 would be big enough. What emerges if you see women in the past, present, and future with eyes of compassion? I was inspired by letters Eshini, wife of Shinran, the founder of Jodo Shinshu Buddhism, wrote to her daughter, Kakushini. This is in the 13th century. The 1921 discovery of these letters offer a glimpse of the thoughts and lives of women in the 13th century Japan. I imagined discovering a letter Mahaprajapati wrote to her son, Siddhartha. Dear Siddhartha, seeing you again fills me with joy, though it seems only yesterday that I cradled you in my arms, heavy with the grief of my sister's passing, your mother. I think she, too, is beaming with delight that you indeed have become a wheel turner and turned the wheel that promises to liberate all beings from suffering. While you were growing up under the weight of becoming a great king, I quietly cared more that you grew to be a person who cared for the well-being of others. When you left the palace, yes, my heart ached to see you go, but I respected your choice and prayed to the gods and goddesses that you would find deep meaning in your quest. Upon hearing that you found what you found would help people stop generating suffering, I had to come and learn for myself. Many women decided to join me, and I am grateful that you have accepted us all without hesitation. I know it takes courage to go against social expectations, and even more courage to go against your own father's intent wishes. I also knew that if you were successful in your quest, you would share it with as many as you could. Because you were always serious, open-minded, and thoughtful, even as a young boy. The glow of tranquility that emanates from you is proof that what you found and now teach is effective. Your primary insights will surely help many people heal, including me. Though it is plain to see there is suffering in our world, like a doctor, you help us understand the cause and cure for this diagnosis. in pinpointing ignorance about the dynamics of impermanence as the cause of suffering, you give us hope that there is a way to stop suffering. There are so many things that we do not have control over in life, but you offer a cure. Set our intention to realize enlightenment. Deepen our understanding of the nature of reality. And focus our concentration with sustained effort. With our whole body minds, we can speak and act with compassion as we choose livelihoods that are non-harmful to others and entrust our lives to the Dharma. No matter how tenuous we might feel, these are things anyone can do. Even though you are the boy I raised, I am impressed by your wisdom to see a path out of suffering, and that you have identified which types of activities will help. The women who came with me from all walks of life already feel their suffering lighten, because no one can stop us from integrating these practices into our lives. Even though men make up much of the structures and economic power in our society, which often makes the lives of women difficult, your teachings help us see that oppressive forces do not have the power to prevent us from being compassionate. Your teachings help us see that those who try to limit women or anyone do not realize that their ignorance is a primary cause of suffering. Many of the women already see that even if their husband insisted they stay home to serve him, she can still maintain her intention to dissolve her ignorance. You have taught us that we can and must navigate our own path out of suffering, and we do not need anyone's permission to do it. Our faith will support us. I am grateful for having the karma to have seen you grow to the heights of human potential. All the hardships involved in you reaching the summit of enlightenment were worth it. For now, countless people will be able to awaken from the ignorance that would otherwise bind them to suffering. Thank you. P.S. Perhaps next time around, you will be my mother, and I will be your child. Unfortunately, we have not discovered such a letter yet. We do have a volume of stories and songs of the earliest Buddhist women, the Terigata, stretching back to the time of the Buddha. It is a treasure trove that illuminates women's motivations, accomplishments, and wisdom in following the Buddhist path. We see how women face the death of loved ones and insights gleaned from aging bodies. We learn of their integrity and awareness, that their own thoughts and actions generated suffering. It even includes a story about a nun's unexpected response to an unexpected sexual advance. Whether the account is literal or metaphorical, it tells us that a woman could respond to events by creatively applying Buddhist principles, in this case, profound non-attachment. A nun named Suba was walking alone in the woods when a man approached her, insistently questioning why such a young woman would become a nun. he persistently tried to entice her with all the pleasure they could have together. She responds with resolute clarity. This fragile body is full of death and headed for the grave. What do you see of value here that makes you stare at me? The man swoons. Your eyes are like those of a doe. They are like the bud of a blue lotus. I am more aroused than before. No eyes are dearer to me than yours. Suba counters. Blind man, you are chasing an empty thing. An eye is just a little ball in a socket. Then she plucked out her eye and gave it to him. His passion died then and there. Thankfully, the story ends with the Buddha restoring her eye. This incident, passed down from well more than 2,000 years ago, would make a sensational Me Too tweet that today women could relate to, though the depth of non-attached response is certainly dramatically rare and hopefully not copied. Suba demonstrates keen wisdom to act in a way that effectively helped a person dissolve the poison of desire and prevent them from generating more suffering. This is the definition of compassion. Much of early Buddhist women's actions and thoughts, however, are lost in the mists of history. They are further clouded over by interpretations of history that are filtered through a male gaze. We can open more space for seeing and understanding historical women by developing interpretations of history that are filtered through a female gaze. Exploring a woman's perspective would be more fruitful if we view both the male and female gaze through eyes of compassion. We could examine a particular historical practice, rule, or teaching and consider whether it would help reduce or eliminate suffering by discerning if there is evidence of ignorance, greed, or aversion. By keeping in sight both the ideal vision of the cessation of suffering and the actual conditions of suffering, we might more readily see how a person who is suffering might respond to the situation with compassion. Then we could imagine how a person of deep commitment to the cessation of suffering might have navigated the less than ideal realities of life, as did the nun Suba. The prevailing interpretation of institutionalized misogynist practices and exclusionary doctrines does not consider how the women might have responded, and intimates that women were unable to reason and apply Buddhist teachings to the conditions with which they lived. The negative treatment of women is only part of the story. We can hone our ability to see and understand women inspired and energized by the Buddhist teachings on the cessation of suffering and practice of compassion by using these as lenses to interpret the historical evidence regarding women recorded in texts, expressed in art and architecture, codified in rules, institutionalized in organizational structures, and encoded in ritual practices. Since we cannot go back and interview women in the past, generating suggestions of well-reasoned, compassionate responses women might have had to historical events will proffer interpretations that take women's faith into account. Women likely took the third noble truth at face value and thought the cessation of suffering was possible for all people. So it is more illuminating to launch our inquiry not with the question, did women seek enlightenment, but rather, how did women seek enlightenment? Adding one word opens up avenues of insight that regard women as agents in their own lives, as caring, hardworking, and serious. Exploring the cumulative tradition from the perspective of women's faith will help us uncover creative ways women might have integrated teachings on non-dual wisdom and loving kindness into their lives. Consider how Siddhartha's father so wanted his son to become a wheel turner of the political world that he went to great lengths to shield him from suffering in order to increase the odds his son would not go on a quest to stop suffering. In contrast, women's lives of the era were intimate with suffering. Death in childbirth, nurturing and burying their babies, caring for the sick, tending to the needs of aged and dying elders. To think that across the 2,500 years of the Buddhist tradition, there haven't been women who sought and gained wisdom regarding healing responses to suffering is a hard case to make. That all people come out of a woman's womb is an underappreciated fact in historical analysis. Women who gave birth 2,500 years ago did not need modern feminist theory to tell them that their bodies are powerful sources of life. Their sons and daughters alike traversed her birth canal, keenly aware of the particulars of female and male bodies, she nourished her sons and daughters with her breast milk. She encouraged their walking and talking. That some sons grew up and wrote down ideas and prescribed rules that did not respect her does not erase her knowledge that her sons were as dependent on her for their survival as were her daughters. What difference might this perspective make on how we interpret what women thought about rules that an elder nun must bow to a young monk? Does she feel like she is less than him? Or might she feel he is like her son and respect his effort to learn the skills of not suffering? Her bowing might help her remove a direct cause of suffering and dissolve notions of being a separate self. Much has been suggested that the issues monks have against women emerged out of their dependence on them for daily food. Practices emerged to help quell monks' desires, such as meditating on a female corpse. I am curious, however, about the faith of the women who woke up early to cook more food than their family needed so they could offer some to the monks each morning. The women's actions did not intimate bitterness about their own lives. Might some women have thought that this was a way to respect the monks, seeing themselves as acting out of compassion? In a tradition that spans 2.5 millennia, it strains the imagination to assume women found no positive meaning in actions they did every day. To do so would require assuming women have no dignity, self-respect, or inclination to be kind. Through most of Buddhist history, women have had numerous positive affirmations of their female bodies, cast in bronze, sculpted in stone, and painted in vibrant colors. Even architectural forms stand witness to the primal importance of women's bodies. Central to early Buddhist ritual practice, the most prominent type of Buddhist monument, the stupa, is a womb. Unfortunately, I do not have time to develop the compelling details that Dr. Miranda Shaw recently published regarding her research on stupas. Cutting to the chase, the half-dome shape of a stupa was likened to a supine pregnant belly, demonstrating that a womb is significant and positive in the Buddhist tradition. The stupa form can help people with wombs feel recognized, affirmed, and perhaps even important. Images, however, can be complicated and not always empowering. I am likely not alone in not appreciating being bombarded by images of impossibly perfect bodies, which are invariably young. Let us look at some older bodies. The two images I want to share of mature people. If you can see one of these images. Okay. Here you can maybe help hold. Mature people featured in medieval Japanese pieces of art. One is a painting and one is a sculpture. If you can't see one, lean or raise your hand.
Yeah, we're sort of scattered out.
Mm-hmm. One is a nun and one is a monk. Which is which? I want to make sure everybody sees this before I say. Have you seen, everyone seen? If you haven't seen, raise your hand. That's faster. Okay. The painting on the The image on the top is, sorry, my text doesn't match what I'm saying. The image on the top is of the Rinzai Zen nun, Mukai Nyodai. Granted, it is often difficult, if not impossible, to know if you are looking at a monk or a nun. The image on the bottom is the Soto Zen monk, Eihei Dogen. I was surprised to read, however, that the image of the elder nun was described in a recent scholarly publication as defeminized. It suggests that there must be certain features present to be recognized as a female. In another recent scholarly publication, interring the remains of a woman in a place she had not been allowed to go when she was alive was characterized, this is medieval Japan, as she characterized by a 2018 publication scholarly volume, that she had transcended gender. I have not heard men who accomplish something significant characterized as transcending their gender. Both of these scholarly interpretations imply being female is a hindrance. So I'm setting everyone free. Find those places where it's insidiously built into what even, this is a volume on women, that they don't even see how they've been brainwashed to take the dominant narrative against women. But we're changing that. The particular form of a body matters. As we see in the intense suffering exacerbated by anti-abortion laws that cause those with wombs to suffer. It is also important to see the suffering
caused by reifying bodies into rigid categories, for gender is a fluid phenomenon. So, as we aim to see women's responses to oppressive events, we must be careful to acknowledge the particular conditions and not be quick to generalize or judge. Compassion does not happen in the abstract. Compassion is a specific action that responds to a clearly understood situation and effectively reduces suffering. Through Eshin-ni's letters to her daughter, Kakushin-ni, we can see the particular ways that Eshin-ni's Shinjin, entrusting faith, enabled her to be strong in the face of adversity. She trusted she would receive a compassionate response to suffering as she weathered hunger and illness. She never expressed doubt. She focused on caring for those around her. Though she was surely aware that traditional Pure Land teachings espoused a doctrine that you must have a male body to be reborn in the Pure Land, she does not betray the slightest hint that she thought that being a woman was an impediment. Perhaps she was not unlike her husband, Shinran, who heeded the Buddhist teachings to not blindly follow, but to test whether or not a teaching was effective in diminishing suffering. After two decades practicing Tendai, Shinran found they were not effective for him, and he decided to follow a new Buddhist leader, Honen. He found Honen's teachings and practices helpful. Likewise, Eshin-ni might have responded to texts that claimed women must be reborn in male form to attain enlightenment or enter the Pure Land were not helpful for diminishing her suffering. She might have thought she must be patient while men learn about non-dual wisdom and deepen their faith in Amida's compassion. Kakushin-ni also demonstrates resoluteness and does not exhibit signs of being inferior due to her femaleness. Her efforts were instrumental in solidifying her father's teachings, which eventually gave rise to the establishment of the Jodo Shin sect, or True Pure Land sect of Buddhism. For women who must navigate a place for themselves in a tradition that privileges being male in its basic aim of being reborn in the Pure Land, what does Amida's compassion feel like? The mother and daughter of Jodo Shinshu model how to navigate the landscape of life and faith, demonstrating that their female forms are not an obstacle to receiving the full force of Amida's compassion. Shin Buddhist women have continued to exhibit a perspicacious understanding of the Dharma, notably evident in a 1932 article by Ohtani Kinuko, a leader in the National Fujinkai, the precursor of the current Federation of Buddhist Women's Associations. She discussed the concerns of temple wives known as bomori, or guardians of the temple. Though without official status, support, or protection, bomori worked with the ordained husbands in meeting the needs of the temple community. Ohtani-san encouraged temple wives to practice Buddhism, not practice Shin rules. Her advice is in direct contrast to the texts written by male leaders of the Shin administration, which stresses Shin rules. Women saw light between Shin rules regarding women and the Dharma. Their actions tell us how their faith in Amida fueled them. Indeed, using Shinran's own logic, If the more depraved a person is, the more likely they will rely on Amida's compassion. And if women are more depraved than men, it stands to reason that women would more likely exhibit devout faith and hence be reborn in the Pure Land. That this might be so does not diminish the force negative teachings, regulations, and institutional structures have had on people. It only makes the women subjected to inferior treatment all the more remarkable when they serve with a smile, bow with gratitude, and lead with faith. Is there too much Xing history and doctrine to have followed all that? Okay. Surely, historically and contemporaneously, numerous myokonin, those heralded in the Jodo Xing communities as exemplars of on-the-ground, everyday Buddhist faith, fill Xing temples as bomori and lay homes as single women, wives, mothers, and daughters. Their sincerity and humility being fundamental to their faith, they do not need recognition from anyone to receive Amida's compassion. Women may also feel Amida's compassion at work in women receiving full institutional support and official acknowledgement for their efforts and contributions. As mothers, they have raised the Jodo Xing community, both inside the temple and inside the home. The intimate modeling of faith or Xingjing while they work, cook, clean, and converse with others over tea seeps into the fabric of life, infusing it with Amida's compassion. In so doing, they buoy our world with people who move with care and flow with gratitude. Over the last three decades, many Japanese Buddhist women have shared their lives with me and showed me how they respond to suffering. Though many are either from Xing or Zen families, none of them are motivated by sectarian concerns. They weave rituals, beauty, gratitude, and compassion into a lifestyle of healing. Permission is not needed from men to practice what they have received from their mothers. Let me share some of the wisdom they cultivate in their hearts, minds, and bodies, starting with Tanaka-san. I met Tanaka-san when she was in her 80s. Her blazing wisdom, a force of nature that draws people to seek her counsel. I tell her I want to speak with her about healing, and she responds by sharing a story. Perfectionism tormented me when I was younger. Adopted at age 7, I never wanted to be a burden to my new parents for fear I might be abandoned. I never relaxed, striving to ever behave like an ideal daughter. Though they treated me well, I believed I was never good enough. Upon becoming a mother, aching to be a good mother, I agonized over the competing obligations of working and mothering. Mothers who worked outside the home were ostracized and evoked animosity in 1960s Japanese society. Believing good mothers did not work outside the home, I convinced myself I failed at mothering. With demoralized heart in hand, I risked repercussions at work to chaperone one of my children's school field trips. As I walked along the hiking trail, feigning fun, my charges bobbing along in their uniform yellow hats, the deep-rooted pain over not being a good mother pierced me. The trail opened to a pond. Rising high above the murky water, majestic, soft pink lotuses blossomed. I trembled at the beauty embedded in such foul water, seeped through the walls of shame I had built in my heart. The blossoming flowers embodied the truth that beauty can grow in mud. As I stood riveted to the scene, my heart finally broke open like a dam, flooding me with an unfamiliar sensation of possibility. Healing wisdom washed over me as I saw through the fallacies that had held me captive. I saw that the circumstances of my life were not a condemnation of my value. The tremendous energy I had devoted to hiding the insidious fear behind my perfectionism came loose and quivered through my body. After the undulations ran their course, I felt emotionally drained. Yet, for the first time in my life, I knew I was strong and worthy. I realized I was a lotus. The muddy conditions of my life were the source of my power, not the cause of my deficiency. Freed from my self-imposed captivity, I looked around and saw my daughter huddled among classmates, squealing with delight at the discovery of baby ducklings trailing their mother through the lotus pond. I realized that my love for my children was enough. They were being raised to be curious and open to the wonders of the world. Pressure to conform to a social ideal of motherhood no longer had a grip on me. I now saw mud as a fount of life-sustaining nutrients in a way that a perfectly sterile environment could never be. People, families, society, and nature flourish because of mud. I was liberated by the insight that mud is the only place lotuses blossom. Healing activities, especially rituals, are concrete acts of compassion that can guide us through our lives, helping to decrease our fear and anxiety and to increase our awareness and connectedness. Such healing rituals flourish in the messiness of life conditions. They are not about right or wrong, nor are they exclusive to any particular tradition. Rather, healing rituals are driven by thoughtful intent and engage our deepest love. When attuned to this love, you can create rituals that are healing. And in turn, when you do a healing ritual, you are in harmony with your deepest self. Whether you are in mundane circumstances or exceptional moments of challenge or even despair, healing rituals permeate the heart and guide you to go deeper than the storms on the surface. They cannot change the past, but healing rituals can help you change your experience of the present. Healing comes in part through focusing on the immediacy of the body, heart, mind, here and now. It is a quality of living that generates compassion for self, others, and the environment. Healing rituals creatively transform barbs into balms. We all want to not suffer, to abide in healing love. Love, like all activities, takes place in the present, which means you can activate it on a moment's notice. It is always available. Though the past formed the foundation of today and the future is full of possibility, we cannot go back and love better yesterday, just as we can't lovingly cut carrots tomorrow for today's soup. Our senses, including our mind senses, are our portals to here and now, and hence to love. No matter what you are doing now, you can choose to move with love. Beauty lures us to see the love-worthiness of all in our midst, to hear the beautiful heart beating under the armor of fear. Beauty summons us to open up, to connect, to love. Beautifying is the cultivation of beauty in how you and the world relate. And this can seem daunting when you take a sober, clear-eyed look at our world. Innumerable individuals ache for healing from sundered relationships. Untold numbers of people feel unworthy of love. Formidable groups of people engage in deliberately divisive tactics. The earth writhes from people not caring. Even in the midst of all this, we can recall that the quality of our relationships depends on the qualities of our hearts. Focusing our hearts on the invisible connections that weave our world together can help us open our hearts ever more and continue to expand our circle of care. Beautifying takes conscious effort, thoughtfulness, and tuning in to the pulse of our interdependent world. To express gratitude is a reliable way to access the beauty in your heart, even when tired, stressed, or angry. With a little attention on the here and now, there are ways and always things for which to be grateful. The list might be whittled down to having enough oxygen content in the air to effectively breathe, enough potable fluids to hydrate, and enough neural synapses to think about air and water. The list of conditions for survival is shockingly short compared to the list of things that threaten survival. This thought alone can be contemplated as an inspiration to be grateful. For a relatively modest effort, the payoff is significant. Those who are moved by Shin Buddha's teachings might feel gratitude flow from Amida Buddha's compassionate vow, and through which expressions of gratitude give rise to a healing life. Whether experienced as cultivated in your own heart or arising out of Amida's gratitude is a direct path to healing. A highly effective antidote to suffering is to embody compassion. To embody compassion sounds lofty, the province of advanced practitioners with equanimous minds, and may feel out of reach for the rest of us who, time and again, leak stress with our gestures, glances, or words. But it needn't be so. One of the most down-to-earth and pragmatically oriented Japanese elder women I met once said something quite wise about this. Quote, "I know I am healed when I am kind." End quote. I suddenly realized that healing is a choice we make in each moment. It does not require decades of effort to offer a warm smile or quietly be present. It is not only the amazing kind people living in our midst that bear responsibility to be compassionate and help others heal. For living is a way of life. For healing is a way of life. Compassion is at home in working in the mud. It goes to the perishing places to ameliorate suffering. No need is too small to be worthy of a compassionate response, nor too complex for many acts of compassion to allay a little suffering. Ever attuned to the intricate dynamics of current conditions, compassion is a specific and concrete act that meets the needs of the moment. One compassionate act can unleash a cascade of beneficent vitality. In sum, healing is seeing everything interrelated in a perpetual dance of change. Healing is connecting with gratitude. Healing is harmonizing with compassion. Healing is creating beauty with the mud. Seeing how lay women in contemporary Japan have learned how to transform their suffering into wisdom about living and healing increases the possibility that women in the past had done so as well. Since how you interpret the past affects what you think of the present, if we look at historical events that caused suffering for women and imagine what a compassionate response might be, it not only opens up possibilities for understanding the past, it gives us more room to breathe freely today. Envisioning the past through the eyes of compassion can inspire us to create compassionate responses to oppressive tactics today. In applying strategies and practices of compassion, we express gratitude for those who paved the way before us. Help us suffer less now and beget a future in which more people can thrive. Let us together till the soil of history with questions from a woman's perspective of the Dharma as we fertilize the present and look forward to reaping a bounteous harvest of compassion in the future. Should I keep this going?
The cook rang the bell, but he said he could keep things warm for another 10 minutes if there's any questions.
It's up to you. I'm here for you if you want.
Could you say a bit about Pure Land Buddhism? What is that and how it relates?
Yeah, sorry. So it's a so-called new sect. It has roots that do begin in India, come around through China, and develop in Japan starting in the end of the 12th century. But in the 13th century, there was a man named Shinran who had a lot of integrity, and he decided he was neither monk nor layperson. He felt he could not keep the vows of celibacy because he couldn't control his dreams. He, you know, had a lot of integrity. So he decided he wasn't going to pretend and be hypocritical. And so he openly married, had a family, and their developed teachings actually were finding out more about the early Buddhist tradition, where people weren't just going for enlightenment. They were going to be in heavens, as we call them, and became pure lands. And so they'd start in India. There's Amida Buddha is a celestial Buddha who is known for his rays of light coming around him. If you know about Zoroastrianism, you know that was the light that came over from Pakistan over into this Amida Buddha. He has a pure land in the West. And so it was also, there was a notion called the degenerate age of the Dharma. I'll just cut to the chase. Nobody thought they could attain enlightenment. But Amida, in his pure land, made a vow that he would help anybody who sincerely, with faith, called on his name. And then his vow was to make sure you get reborn in this pure land, which is not enlightenment. It's just a place where once you're born there, all the conditions for attaining enlightenment are present. And so people shifted their goal from being to try and get enlightened to just trying to be reborn in this pure land. And then they could be enlightened there.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Yeah.
So the Amita Buddha.
Yeah.
How did people trust the authenticity? And I'm not questioning it. But I'm just curious. Did the Shakyamuni Buddha talk about the Amita Buddha?
No, it's a much, much longer, complicated story. But suffice it to say, wars, famines, all kinds of things were happening in Japan at the time. And so someone says, have faith in Amida Buddha. He's vowed to help you if you just say his name sincerely. Most people are just too busy. They didn't read anyways. And so they're not reading sutras. They don't care, you know, like shot the arrow in the heart, you know, just get the arrow out. Don't ask why. And that was kind of the mentality. So people were told, just do this. And like, they're desperate. They're hungry, you know, and they're just like, okay, I'll do this. And it gave people a sense of being safe. Like, it's not all despair. There's something bigger out there helping me, and it's compassionate. And so it is the most, in terms of followers, it has the most numerous followers in Japan today, because it's so accessible. This is the short version of Pure Land, but hopefully enough.
Could you tell me, please, the literal meaning of Shin in English?
It's sometimes translated as it's faith, but there's also, there's a Pure Land Buddhism and this new true Pure Land Buddhism, so there's a true meaning to it as well, but
the original, the etymology, is it a Chinese word originally?
Yeah, so it's faith, trust, entrusting without a calculating heart.
Okay, thanks.
Purity, sincerity. The not calculating part is critical. You're not trying to game the system. Oh, I can't attain enlightenment because I can't do Zazen long enough, so I'm going to try this. No, it's to totally let yourself be vulnerable, fall into the emptiness that Amida's compassion is so big you're not going to fall out.
Okay. Can I ask one
yes.
more? I just want to say one more thing, which is I so appreciate mud being appreciated because from the point of view of nature, mud is an amazing
yes.
State of things to be,
yes.
very supportive of life.
Yes, yes.
So I just thank you for being I have a question that's forming in my head, so please excuse if the words aren't the right words. So what I'm hearing from your stories is that the history has helped form conditions for men to approach Zen in a more scholarly way, you know, like the monks being able to sit for long hours and being able to read texts, and women, it seems to me like the conditions were more inducing women training in what I would call everyday Zen, like approaching life and life's hurdles and connecting with people with a Zen, with Zen intentions, and not having, you know, the time and the conditions to approach it in a more scholarly way.
Mm-hmm.
So the question that is coming up for me, because until the September rituals, I was always very kind of happy with embodying Zen in the world, and I kind of thought that was the secret role of women, to have that secret wisdom that they share with each other and that they embody and they bring into the world just by being Zen, and almost seeing men as speaking Zen.
Mm-hmm.
And what I loved about the voices of women in Zen is that it's focusing on, okay, how about we speak about what we know and what we've
mm-hmm.
learned over the years. And so the question that's forming is, have these conditions helped create women as scholars, as teachers possibly of everyday Zen, of how do you live Zen in other conditions than when you study Zen?
So the short answer is yes, but I the scholarly study of the Buddhist tradition in the West has been totally from the male perspective. So a lot of the information you have perhaps been taught in books in English, you know, like they say, the Buddhist tradition is misogynist, and this is what I train my students to do. Like, are you saying then all the women in the Buddhist tradition were misogynist? No, the men are misogynist. And so the sleight of hand with the words, you know, women could not officially do such and such, or they are not, they don't have authority to do such and such. That's, oh, you always have to add, by the men. And we do not know enough of the historical record, but we know enough of the historical record that women have been a through line at the in the monastic and domestic streams of the tradition all along, regardless of whether the men acknowledge them or not. And so that is something I really want the narrative to be cracked open. And I don't want to hear someone say the Buddhist tradition is misogynist. I want people to say the men in the Buddhist tradition have instituted misogynist practices, teachings that are even in the sutras and in the official organizations. But that's not the Dharma. And so it's true that there have been, there have been more laymen and laywomen than there have been monastics in Buddhist history. So I don't want to single out, gee, the women at home had their own kind of practice. Mm-hmm. I would imagine the men did too, but they had to overcome the obstacle of people holding them up as higher, so their ego got built up stronger, mm-hmm. which is an obstacle mm-hmm. to dissolving the ego. Mm-hmm. So they have a harder path to follow, mm-hmm. and that's not appreciated enough. And that it's true, women having been held down, yes, suffering, I'm not questioning that. That's an important part to not lose sight of. But the opportunities to question, you know, like we know about the subaltern, anyone who has been oppressed knows the people who are holding them down better than the people who are holding them down know themselves. You have to survive. And so I take that as how women have been creative, determined, careful, not to maybe raise red flags So they can just fly under the radar and just, yeah, he doesn't understand non-dualism. You know, they don't have to make everything into an argument. They know you got to eat, you got to stay warm enough, you know, when you're sick, you got to get healthy. And so they understand compassion is concrete. And the men often are acculturated in ways that actually take them further away from concrete compassion and can discuss the details of, is this compassionate or not? When it really is the person who's experiencing it, am I suffering less or not? It's not up to someone else to decide. It's up to each person to say, this is helping me or not. So I want the field of Buddhist studies, I'm doing my part to open up the narrative and help us see the tradition more fully. And of course, not just the whole purpose of doing it in the academic world is really just to hone my chops to help people in the bigger world not be snowed by this scholarship.
A priest in a sangha I'm connected with, she talked about, we were talking about where we fit. She talked about, and in the spectrum between male and female, she's in the middle. And that was really helpful to me because it shows we are all a mix, instead of there's a woman or there's a guy. It's like we each have those parts. And so that was enormously helpful to dispel the duality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's, I was just reading, I'm so sorry, I was comfortable in a chair and was cold and had a blanket on and didn't go get up and get a pencil and paper. I was reading in some sutra that explained the spectrum of genitalia. It was in a sutra. And it wasn't the Vinaya saying, oh, if you got this kind, you can't go there. And it wasn't discriminatory. It was just putting it out there. And I thought, wow, I will refine it. It's just been in the last 2 weeks, so I think I can retrace my steps. I hope I can. But so, I mean, you know, those sutras that talk about sex transformation and, you know, goddesses turning into male bodies, you know, the Lotus Sutra, the dragon princess. And there's a question, well, is she affirming you have to be male to be enlightened? Or is she saying, okay, these poor men, they don't get it, so I'll turn into a male so they will recognize my enlightenment. But it's really they aren't enlightened because they think I need to be male when there is no male or female. There, throughout the Buddhist sutras, there is that language, that concern. It's not a modern concern, although it's wonderful that it's more on people's minds and consciousness. But it's always been there. And, you know, it's all about our perception. And anytime you reify anything, that's why I thought, oh no, I'm in this chair of women in Buddhism when at a time when I don't want to reify women in an essentialist way. But just like we understand that we need to talk about Black Lives Matter because there has been a terrible injustice that has happened and continues, I think there is a place to continue talking about women, although in the context of understanding it's all empty, but to not diminish that those who are perceived as female have been treated in certain ways that have generated suffering. So it's always a dance, and there's no one right way. It's always, what are the conditions in which invoking this metaphor or that metaphor is going to liberate?
And just like you don't take the raft with you when you reach the other shore, you don't take your gender identity and these terms with you either, although they can help be guideposts that you can't, you have to leave them at the shore.
So I would like to offer, along with that thought, that the discrimination came from institutions, not from individuals. And that the individuals suffered from the institutions as much as those that were discriminated against suffered.
Yeah.
And so it's not gender, it's not men, it's not women. We now understand, in the latest work of feminism, that it is institutions that discriminate against both.
Yes, I totally agree with you. But when you break down an institution, there are people who have made choices to maintain it. I mean, look what we did with the institution of the presidency. How one person could change it so dramatically when there were supposed to be checks and balances. And I that's what I meant by the poor men who have to be acculturated, that have their egos built up and given this burden to carry. It makes it harder to dissolve your ego. And yes, you get acculturated, but that's, to me, the whole Buddhist project. Why we still struggle with anatman, not being a self, is because that concept of being a self is so tenacious. And I would say it's more fundamental than an institution. And yet the Buddhist teachings tell us we have to dissolve that concept. No one can do it for us. And there is no outside force that can dissolve an institution. And so people who are in the institution, from a Buddhist perspective, the people in the institution, yet that are generating systemic oppression, they have a heavy burden to carry. And I do not think it's easy. And so in some ways, you know, the woman who's told, okay, you got to bow down to the youngest men, the youngest monk, in a way, that's more in keeping with the what we know helps dissolve suffering. I mean, yeah, dissolve suffering by dissolving the ego. And if you are part of an institution that builds your ego up, you have a bigger burden to dissolve that. But there is no, that's just perception that we all have to work with. But yes, there's an extra burden for those inside oppressive institutions, but they are not absolved of the need to do their own dissolution. There's no other way to do it that I know of.
One question, one more question,
yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
For
It's just to have a microscope, very good microscope on positive reinforcement. As you said, the biggest burden with positive, giving you candy for certain behavior, and I like candy. It's a hard thing that you're, but thank you.
May our intentions equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. The Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become